design the patterns for his ties. What a schlep. We couldn't go to a mall without my dad stopping into a few stores just to see who carried what. He was always doing research. To this day, my father still points at stores as we drive by and declares, "I used to sell to them." I do the same thing when I pass a random building I once did comedy in Los Angeles. I can't help but point it out to whoever I'm with. "I did a show there once." No one cares but me. But it's a funny thing to measure a lifetime of accomplishment by staring at buildings you once worked in. I imagine myself, old and gray, telling my grandkids, "I once did a show for 5 people in the upstairs of an Acapulco Mexican restaurant. Now it's a robot grocery store, and we all speak Russian." I guess I never assumed his business wasn't doing well, because he was my dad, and he worked hard. Slowly, the menswear business dried up. Sure, men still needed accessories, but the market grew smaller and more competitive. I was 21 and home from college, about to make my move to Los Angeles. I was in the car with my father. I thought he was just dropping me off, but he put the car in park. He looked at me and, with tears in his eyes, explained how difficult it had been for him, closing his business and having a family to support. He knew giving up wasn't an option, and he wanted me to be proud of him. Me? Proud of him? The thought had never occurred to me. Parents are supposed to be proud of their kids, right? The other way around seemed irrelevant. Why would an adult care what a kid thought? As an adult, I understand what losing a business must have been like for him. It's like losing a part of your soul. It's an entity you've poured your sweat and tears into. It reflects you, and when it dies, you lose something major. It's a little like a breakup or even a death. You wonder what more you could have done to save it, to turn things around. It's a part of your energy and life that's gone. I remember crying for the whole weekend when my first late-night pilot didn't go through. I didn't understand how something I worked so hard for, something that had so much of my heart in it, could just be casually passed on. You can't help but wonder, was I not enough? Does the universe not want me to have what I want? Or worse, am I as misguided as the 99% of delusional people out in Los Angeles? Am I one of the crazies? No. The universe always wants you to be happy. And in hindsight, that pilot was terrible. We'll blame the executives on that one, though. They wanted me to say stuff like, "Keep it 100! Puke. Anyway, I don't know if I'd ever seen my dad cry, and he wasn't like sobbing, but his eyes got that clear color that blue eyes get when holding tension and tears back. I know this look because I have his eye color, and I happen to think I look really pretty when I cry. My dad explained that he was getting into a brand new business, financial planning. Now, if that doesn't sound like a total dad job, I don't know what does. But beyond the job, what he was telling me was that he was starting over at 49. At 49, with 2 children at home, a wife, a dog, a house, all the typical American dream stuff surrounded by a nightmare of a situation. Here he was, at an age many men are starting to fantasize about retiring, in the process of completing the 3 exams necessary to acquire a license to practice a business he had never worked a day in. I was in awe of his fortitude. I think a change like that might paralyze some people, but he moved through it with muscle and determination. 12 years later, my father now teaches financial planning workshops and is one of the top financial advisors in his company. On that day, in that car, sitting in the sweltering Texas heat, my dad, through his actions, made it clear to me that nothing ever needed to stop me from moving forward with passion and purpose. Giving up is just not an option. But that doesn't mean I don't struggle with the sting of failure or self-doubt. Here's an example of my girl logic-driven thought process on most things related to work. I get a call from my manager telling me, "The network wants to talk to you about your script." Because I've never had a script greenlighted before, my automatic defense thinking is, great, they're going to pass on it. Then, feeling preemptively defeated, I start reevaluating all my other projects. That won't go, this other project won't go, and if this other thing doesn't go, ugh, after a year and a half of writing, now I'm back to just doing stand-up. Fuck, I'm a total loser. I'm going to be 43 and playing the Giggle Shack in Dayton. Then I'll sit with that. Maybe all day, maybe all week. In a way, I guess I choose to focus on the negative versus basking in the positive. I use it as a motivation tool, but I also do it because some part of me doesn't think anything I've done is actually all that great. And I hate myself for it. It's hard wanting to move the cultural needle, be part of a bigger conversation, make an impact, but feel like I'm continually getting left out of bigger projects. I've never made a legit top comics to watch list. I've never been on any sort of tastemaker list. I don't have a ton of social media followers compared to most celebrities. I'm not part of anyone's passion project. I've never been on a hit TV show or really been in movies. Basically, for the past 8 years, I've solely been doing stand-up. My failed pilots and auditions all relegated to my memory. And I love stand-up. So, so much. But watching other people skyrocket past you, and this obviously can apply to many industries and various aspects of life, is, well, painful. This might read as sour grapes, but it isn't. I'm just being honest. It is possible to be happy and angry and proud and unsatisfied all at the same time. That's not even girl logic. That's just a human experience. Ever since I was a kid, I've been a questioner. While almost everyone else around me seemed to plod along, buying into everything they were told, I was interrogating everything. What do I really want? What's the point of all this? Why do I have to listen to what these idiots say? Why do I have to accept this ref's call in a game? Why do I have to say yes, ma'am, to a teacher whose only intellectual saving grace is that she has the answer book? A majority of people don't question anything, ever. People too often think the hand they've been dealt can't be shuffled and redealt. There's just no way you don't possess the power to change your own reality. I'm not talking about in a metaphysical way. I have no idea how to explain that. I'm saying whatever you want to do, there's no rule saying you can't. You want to be a comedian? Go to a local bar and ask if you can start a comedy night. Practice and carve out a path, whether it's classes, clubs, whatever. You want to be a scientist? Get up in that science. You got rejected from school? Good thing there are other schools out there. Remember, there's no reason you have to accept defeat. Don't believe me? Ask, I don't know, any immigrant living in America. My cousin posted this meme once on Facebook. Everyone is doing the best they can. And I did not like it, because I don't know if I truly believe that. People are doing what they can to get by, sure, but very few people are imbued with a passion, and where there is no passion, there is no concerted effort. Can you grow a passion if you don't have an innate one? Of course. You can call 1-800-RENT-A-PASSION. No, but really, you may not know you have a proclivity for something until you're exposed to it, or thrust into it, or suddenly your life takes an unexpected turn, and that thing is suddenly all you can focus on. Like those newspaper stories about the mom of a murder victim who becomes obsessed with getting a law degree and changing the system from the inside. She found her passion in a tragic way, but her life has meaning now. I mean, even drug abuse gives people a passion. It's one of the few fucked up paths you can go down where, if you survive it, you can turn around and educate others on the perils of addiction. I'm like, let me get this straight. So I didn't do drugs, didn't go to jail, and didn't accidentally kill someone with my car, but now you're the one with a 24 college a year speaking engagement schedule? Not fair. Passion is doing something over and over and over and never growing tired of it. And no, breathing doesn't count. Anyway, I didn't know I would have a passion for stand-up comedy until I found myself obsessed with working on it, perfecting it. Everything from traveling constantly to insisting on working while I'm sick to seeing how many projects I can keep in the air at once, I have a passion for being as busy as I can be, but only with comedy. I find a sick thrill in being overworked, in taking 5 meetings a day and still having time to do 3 spots a night, as if someone's going to spontaneously hand me an award for most overextended at the end of the year with like an okay amount of results to show for it. I also didn't know I had a passion for singing 5-second songs to my dog on Snapchat until I started doing it. Small and rare, small and rare, you shake it for cash, you do it for tips, small and rare is one classic. Another is, tiniest woman in the world, littlest doggy in the land, tiny, 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 tiny. And you got a big butt, and it's not your fault. You got a big butt, and it's all your fault. These are the songs, along with about 50 others, that are on a constant loop in my brain. And I didn't know I had such a passion for connecting with humans until my fans showed me how much my stand-up meant to them. Now that connection is what drives me. Thanks, guys. What if you're someone who doesn't have a passion yet? I don't think you can force it, but you can hope for it, try new things, and keep striving for one. And in my opinion, women are more adept at this than men are. Remember that part from the beginning of the book about women accumulating more and more hobbies and interests as they age? It's because our girl logic wants us to keep pushing and exploring. Our girl logic won't let us rest until we found our true happiness, or at least pin down a path toward it, because again, we were told we could have it all. Plus, I'd like to think everyone has something that they have the potential to be both great at and greatly excited about. I would like to think that it's laziness that keeps people from being great, not ineptitude. Someone's got to do the grunt work. The majority of people out there have good hearts, but so many seem to simply be doing whatever they can to get by instead of pushing themselves to find a bigger meaning, which I realize isn't always easy, especially if you're born into shitty circumstances. You can be born rich And having that inherent safety net makes you feel like you never need to strive for anything, so you fuck around, maybe you start DJing. You can be poor, and, well, you don't need me to explain why being poor presents major disadvantages all around. But I truly believe that caring about something, something besides, like, killing people, is the key to a fulfilled life. I'm fortunate to have found my passion from a young age. It's never occurred to me that I shouldn't be pursuing that full speed ahead. But as much as Girl Logic is trying to help us advance toward our true purpose, it can also be a burden. The fears start to swirl. Go for your passion too hard and you might miss out on marriage. Travel the world and live free, well, you might miss out on a chance for a baby. Don't travel or wander enough and you might miss out on, everything else. We still keep trying to meet everyone else's ideals, but it's tiring. The year I wrote this book, 2016, was the culmination of years of hard work for me. I got a script into a network that had been in the works for 2 years. I created Confirmed Kills as my opus. I finally got a shot at a late night show. But learning to let go of what others think I should be doing has been a long, tough process. And fuck no, I'm not some Zen master who's magically learned to accept everything and everyone as they are. Dear God, sometimes it's so bad that I'll forget why I dislike someone and just hold on to that anger. And I'm left with this vague, shapeless feeling of dissatisfaction cloaking my brain. It's like anger dementia. You'll go to hug me at a party, and after I flinch, you'll secretly wonder, what the hell did I ever do to her? And I skulk away like, you know what you did, but I don't even know. Anyway, like I said, I realize I'm too tough sometimes. I sat with that realization for a while after receiving one particular dressing down. The gist of it was this. I had a show with a network, and execs pitched various ideas to me about how we might promote it. Of course, every idea was, well, epically wrong for me. They kept trying to shove me into some hypersexualized, sassy single girl archetype, the one who constantly brags about one-night stands, the perils of dating, how hilariously pathetic my Saturday nights are, and why wine is my best friend. I'm not that girl, though. This happens a lot, of course. It's how you end up at a photo shoot perched on a motorcycle in a leather jacket and too much black eyeliner thinking, I took a boxing class once. I'm not this badass. Ugh, this feels off-brand. I made the mistake of expressing my displeasure. I can't remember whether I said I was offended, God forbid a woman be upset about your ill-conceived presumptions of her sexuality, or that I straight up didn't like their pitch, but months later, after a decent season, we were told that my show wasn't being renewed. Fine, whatever, that happens. Then it came down the pipeline that I was difficult to work with. What hurt wasn't that it got canceled. It was that one conversation, months ago, rendered me the scapegoat simply for standing up for myself. I might be particular, but I pride myself on being consistently on my game when it comes to work. I don't fuck around, show up late, or arrive not knowing my lines. I show up, do my job well, and leave. So after that experience, I found myself feeling angry, sure. Unheard, yes, and exhausted. I was angry that people can create art only to have faceless egg avatar shit on them. I was angry that women can work their whole lives only to be reduced to a Reddit thread about their tits. I was angry that some executive took umbrage with my taking umbrage, and rather than do his job and come up with a more creative idea, he took the lazy route and blamed me. That's when I stopped giving a fuck about picking every battle. More on this to come shortly. I think there's a way to not care while still caring, if that makes sense. In the future, I'll be more careful about who I say what to. Your girl logic might tell you to stand up for yourself, but it also reminds you that if you do, you run the risk of pissing off someone weaker than you, who might also be in a greater position of power. It's a tough call, and you can drive yourself mad weighing out all the outcomes, and once in a while, you pick the right battle, and you win. My rule in both work and life is to always bet on myself. To stand up for myself, to try to get a head start on all the haters. Jesus, I can't believe I just sincerely used the word haters. May as well write the rest of this book as a Snapchat story. Always do things your way first. If you have an idea for a project, lay it out there. If you love someone, say it. If you want something, fucking go for it. Hey, even if you fail, you'll know you gave it your all. And it's hard to look back with regret on anything if you tried as hard as you could. Also, if it's your passion, you'll never actually give up. You might get tired, but you'll snap back. About 2 years ago, I got in bed with a very good production. It's Ellen DeGeneres' company. What I wanted to do was pitch a show about me and my life as a comedian, which made sense. I mean, every meeting I took for the past 3 years, all anyone could ever talk about was women in comedy, funny women, blah, blah, blah. I figured if Seinfeld, John Mulaney, Louis, and a smattering of other guys had gotten to write a show and proudly and openly proclaim that they were real-life stand-up comedians at the same time, who better than me to say, I'm a woman and a stand-up comedian, and this is my story. Ellen's company liked the idea, and they said I should get paired with a writer to draft an outline. At the time, I had written one other script with Sex and the City's Cindy Shupak. So the idea of being paired with a powerful, more seasoned writer seemed like the logical way to go. After all, I wasn't a sitcom writer. A few weeks later, I got a call telling me that this acclaimed writing team was interested in me. Knowing that I don't know everything, I met with them and signed on. Did I love them? Eh. But when the bigger picture is getting a show on a network, I decided I could learn to like them, especially if I had to learn that lesson from atop a pile of money. Then I got another call. They didn't like the comedian idea. Now they wanted to do a show about me and my dating life. I hated their take on it, and I asked if I could at least say I was a stand-up so we'd each be getting something. They said I could mention it, but it was really about dating. Okay. Deep breath, and repress the rage at being pigeonholed. Eye on the prize. We took some meetings. They wrote an outline. For those of you who don't know, in Hollywood, there's a time called pitch season when writers, comedians, and producers go to networks to pitch ideas for a script. A week before we were set to pitch the dating idea, the writing team called Ellen's production company and said, "We want full creative control." Now, since there were two of them, they already had 50% control. This wasn't a decision they were making after mulling it over. This was a strategic move done at the last minute to put pressure on me to say, "Oh no, I don't want to miss pitch season. Yes, you can have control. Just get me my show." It didn't feel right, creatively, emotionally, and ethically. So I said, "The idea that after this many years of me writing my own stand-up, that these two think they could write my voice and that I wouldn't be at every meeting and in every writer's room for the show is insane. They can't have full creative control." The answer is no. They thought I was a nobody so they could bully me. Their people called back and said that they weren't budging. I was faced with the idea of being underestimated and having to compromise myself creatively. I'm never opposed to taking advice and guidance from someone smarter. I'm always into the idea of collaborating with someone better than me. But I didn't know these people, and, well, they were assholes. I called my agent back and I said I was walking away. I knew that if I'd gotten this far without them, I could do it again. The next week I had a call with my executive at a very good production. I decided to lay it all out there and said, "I think it's time to do a show where a woman gets to say she is a stand-up comedian, and there's no woman more qualified than me. This is my life, and I want to write about it." I knew he was going to say no. The silence on the other end of the line told me that this, like so many of my ideas, would be a hard pass. Then I heard him say, "We totally agree." And I said, "In theory," or... He laughed. "We want to work with you. We are invested in you." I had never heard those words before. I choked out, "You mean, like, on this, or hypothetically in the future?" No, he meant this. He meant now. I added, "And I want to write it myself." He said, "We totally agree." And I quickly added, "Ooh, and I want a pony." Nothing. But a few months later, I got to write that pilot myself, and someone even bought it. I had earned the chance to create the show I wanted on my terms. I got there by betting on myself and refusing to sell my ideas short. This past year of my life has been all about betting on myself, even when it comes to this book. I've pitched versions of Girl Logic for years. The talk show I got on Freeform in 2017 was the result of 4 late-night pilots on 3 different networks over the course of 5 years. My first theater tour was a result of more than 7 years of nonstop road dogging. My hair is slowly starting to get thicker because I started taking vitamins. See, literally nothing other than zits, regret, and flowers bloom overnight. Figuring out what makes you happy can be a minute-to-minute adventure or a lifelong endeavor, but never stop. I know one thing for sure. Whatever you want is out there, and the universe wants you to find it. Unless it's thinner thighs, in which case, I'm pretty sure I'll be taunted by the universe forever. Afterward, I care, you care, we all care, but not all the time. This book was not written as an autobiography because at 34, I still don't feel I have accomplished enough to write it all down and say, "This is the story of how I made it." The reality is, I haven't made it yet, and even when I do, I doubt I will realize it. If anything, I could offer a guide on how to work really hard to get to the middle and explain the journey thus far. But I know about how girls think. I know what hard work and stand-up feels like, and I know that I have so much more to learn and accomplish. I also thought that writing from the perspective of someone still in the trenches would be helpful. Hindsight always brings relief. Once you've made your money and become a success, it's easy to spout out platitudes like, just enjoy the ride. But it's hard to enjoy the ride when it's making you nauseous and scared and you aren't sure when it will be over. I wrote this book while on the ride. I'll let you know how I feel when it's over. Unless I'm dead. As a woman in comedy, I have to lead with strength. As I did the emotional excavating of writing this book, I realized that something born out of necessity has grown into something of a detriment for me. I might be too tough. I know I've preached the idea that a woman can't be too confident, and I definitely still believe that. But on a personal note, being constantly prepared for a fight has become exhausting. I walk around tense and hypervigilant, poised to strike. It's only within the past year that I've learned to let go of my obsession with what everyone else is doing and what everyone else thinks of me. I finally began to chill and take some comfort in the fact that all I can do is what I'm doing. Part of it came because I realized that I was fighting against something that would never change. People would never stop moving past me. Things would never completely go my way. But I would never stop trying. Me trying was the only thing I could control. That and not looking at social media as much. It's all poison. It just reminds you that you aren't perfect enough, famous enough, accomplished enough, and that everyone around you is dying of cancer and the planet is turning into a giant ball of melted ice caps and plastic. Want to know why you have anxiety? Because you hit the discover button on Instagram too much. Discover this. It can be hard to play passive, sit back and not care, or even pretend not to care. Women are taught that a lot of our success rides on our ability to be likable. Men, however, are lauded for being stoic and remote, for not giving a fuck. On them, it's considered attractive. No one questions what men are giving up by being so strong. No one says, sure, he kicks ass in the boardroom, but he had to give up having kids. No one calls a man an ice queen when he's standoffish or says he just needs to get laid when he's frustrated or asks, wow, what did your dad do to you when he's angry? And this, it all just makes me even more determined to be true to myself in every circumstance. It no longer matters to me what people think of my strength, my occasional aloofness, or my bouts of rage about the state of humanity. I'm a woman and I get mad. Don't like it? Look away! Of course, girl logic makes it incredibly difficult to not give a fuck what people think of you, your decisions, your job, your everything. Again, there's the likability factor. Other people's perceptions are a far greater enemy to women than they are to men, and they can be deadly. She seems slutty. She seems like a ball buster. She seems like someone who reminds me of someone who hurt me. Some days all you can think is, why try? The thing is, I have no interest in superfluous pain. I like winning, but I never throw the first punch. I don't have the energy to try and win every fight anymore, and walking around constantly preparing myself to do battle only keeps me in a perpetual state of tension and anxiety. For years, if I looked up at the Comedy Store lineup or at a marquee and I saw a comic's name that I didn't like for any reason, competition, disagreements, or even just random awkwardness, I would spend all night feeling nervous about running into them. One day, I just stopped. I started asking myself, what's the worst that could possibly happen? Are they going to pull me aside and attack me? Nope. Worst case, we would see each other, nod, and keep walking. It's crazy how often we forget to have a rational discussion with ourselves about the worst possible outcome. See, somewhere between putting too much weight on being liked and being obnoxiously selfish lies your individual version of bliss. Everyone wants to be loved. Everyone wants to feel included and appreciated. Sometimes the shittier someone is, the more they need outright adulation. Women should be especially mindful of this as we claw our way to happiness. Give another girl a compliment every now and again, knowing she took just as long to get ready as you did, and her girl logic probably erroneously convinced her nothing in her closet would ever look cute enough. Be kind, be gracious, be above it all, and if none of that works, fuck what anyone else thinks you tried. It might sound cynical, but one major lesson I've learned by living in Hollywood is that nothing we do really matters. That red carpet dress you spent weeks finding, no one's gonna remember it next year. That date you went on when you gave the guy a weird impression and he ghosted on you immediately after dropping you off, guess what? He's married now and doesn't think about you, just like you probably don't remember half the guys you've blown off. Upsetting people, worrying about outfits, fretting over how you looked or sounded in a conversation, none of it matters because if I asked you right now what you wore or did or said last year on this day, you wouldn't remember. Facebook would, but only your mom is looking through those lame digital albums it makes. Of course, it's hard to remember all that stuff in the moment when you actually need it. Here's an embarrassing anecdote, though, to illustrate. I remember being at a Netflix Emmy party a few years ago, and Orange is the New Black was the belle of the ball. I didn't typically drink at events, but this one was different because, well, I was leaving early to go meet a boy. On my way out of the party, I saw Adrienne Seymour, who plays Tova. I'd been so in love with her character arc that season, and I was such a huge fan of the show for what it did for women, lesbians, and women of color in particular. Anyway, in my buzzed excitement, I trotted up to her and blurted out, "Oh my God, I'm such a fan. You were amazing in the episode where you converted to Judaism." I was ready for us to bond over that scene. We would swiftly become best friends, obviously. Exhausted, not just from having come from the governor's ball, but probably from a lifetime of white girls saying whatever they wanted to her, she looked at me and said, "That's not me. I was talking to the wrong actress. I was talking to Danielle Brooks, who plays Tasty." God fucking no, I don't think all black people look alike. It was a mortifying mistake, but I was drunk and overly excited, and to be totally fair, not wearing contacts and coming at her from afar. Regardless, in that moment, I wanted to throw a smoke bomb and yell, "This never happened!" and disappear. As a rush of hot embarrassment washed over me, I remembered, wait, she has no idea who I am, and this doesn't need to matter. I said, "I sincerely apologize." She told me it was fine, and I turned on my heels and waited for her to walk away. I felt horrible, but I took an odd comfort in knowing that what I'd said would probably be the last thing on her mind on a night as big as this. I truly hope she doesn't remember it. I hope I didn't taint her wonderful night with the memory of someone unintentionally saying something stupid, but I was never happier to not be famous and recognizable than in that moment. If anything, that forgiveness is something I chose to pay forward a year later when a waiter scurried up to me at the upfronts and said, "Oh, you are my favorite stand-up comic. I can't believe I'm blanking on your name. Oh, Ilana Glazer." Not only do she and I not look alike, but I don't think she does stand-up. Still, I knew he was a fan of mine and perhaps simply said the more famous girl whose first name started with an I. I smiled, knowing it really didn't matter and knowing he meant well. Truth is, though very few things actually matter in the long run, girl logic can help you suss out what matters to you, personally, the most. Sure, strive to be kind, but you can't always treat others the way you want to be treated, because sometimes others are so dense, you're pretty sure clubbing them over the head might be the only thing they'll understand. I have to stop myself once an hour and remind myself that the universe isn't against me, that the woman in front of me in line at CVS didn't wake up and think, "How am I going to make Eliza's life miserable today?" Honestly, try as I might, I do believe there is a secret meeting in Los Angeles every morning at 5 where people gather and get their annoyance assignments for the day. I bet people are given tasks like, just get in your car and drive on the freeway, any freeway. Do whatever you can to create more traffic and not contribute to society. Oh, and make sure when your car breaks down, you never push it off to the shoulder. Or the people at the airport who don't know the rules, you know the ones. It's like, we are in a TSA line. Yes, you have to throw out your fucking water. You have had to throw it out for the past 16 years. Today isn't any different. There is still a war on terror. But then I remember it doesn't actually matter, that I don't have to give a fuck about every little bump in the road. The minor irritations, the major fuck-ups, yes, they hurt, and it's a minute-to-minute conscious decision to move past it and focus on the future. Girl logic, as I said, is all about the gray, and figuring out just how much you actually care about the stuff you think you care about. You'll drain yourself of both energy and fucks to give if you throw them at every little thing. But the fact that I'm given the chance to create because I pushed for my chance to create, that's what matters most to me. Your girl logic will help prepare you for a million scenarios where things can go utterly wrong, and it will help you survive when everything else falls apart. Rejection happens, but unless you're dying, there's no reason you can't use your girl logic to help you create an even better opportunity. Anything good in this world was created by someone who cared enough to fail over and over. That's why I feel sorry for kids who inherit money, and thereby power. They miss out on the thrill of failure and the rush that comes from rebuilding. See, girl logic will always help you rebuild. Whether it's prompting you to try an insane and awesome new look after a terrible breakup, launch a new career after a job loss, shape a new life after a divorce, give chances to people who hurt you, or rethink your idea after you pitch a black version of Harry Potter called Black Magic that no one was into. I still have the outline if anyone wants. It behooves you to listen to your girl logic, at least say 75% of the time. At the beginning of this book, I explain that girl logic makes up the thought processes that help you weigh out the past, present, and future in every little decision you make. I also said that most of your decisions won't truly matter in the long run. So what can you do? You can give yourself a break when you're tired. You can work hard when it's important, and you can try to remember that you are the one in charge of your own happiness. Also, I know this is hard to wrap one's mind around, but most people are too selfish to ever try to make you unhappy. If someone pisses you off, it's usually by mistake. If it's deliberate, try feeling sorry for them because they're just jealous or deranged or they're just a bully who had shitty parents. Finally, allow me to leave you with the tips I give aspiring comics, aside from be funny. Be kind, work hard, don't take shit from anyone, and remain merciful. Thank you for listening to my book. Bye-bye!
This has been an Audible Studios production of Girl Logic, written and performed by Eliza Schlesinger. Foreword written and performed by Mayim Bialik. Executive producer Mike Charzak. Copyright 2017 by Eliza Schlesinger. Sound recording copyright 2017 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.